are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. At the beginning of 2020, Dr. Peter McCullough was a highly regarded practicing physician, program director, teacher, and clinical investigator at a major academic medical center in Dallas, Texas. When COVID-19 arrived in March, he felt a duty to find a treatment for the disease. He wasn't alone. Other doctors all over the world were also searching for a cure. They followed the long-standing principle that it's best to tackle a sickness early, before it becomes life-threatening. This is the story of how Dr. McCullough and his colleagues developed an early treatment protocol of generic, repurposed drugs and supplements that has saved millions of COVID-19 patients from hospitalization and death. In spite of their success, their early treatment protocol was not welcomed by public health officials. On the contrary, the news of their promising results was dismissed as soon as it was reported. At first, this seemed like conventional skepticism, but then fraudulent papers maligning the protocol's repurposed drugs were published in academic medical journals. This and other acts of fraud revealed that a coordinated smear campaign against early treatment was being waged. Dr. McCullough and his colleagues soon found themselves censured, censored, attacked in the media, and fired from their jobs. The greatest victims of the smear campaign were COVID-19 patients who were consequently deprived of early treatment. Hundreds of thousands needlessly died of the disease. At the same time early treatment was suppressed, the U.S. government and mainstream media proclaimed that the cure to COVID-19 lay in a new generation of vaccines that were being developed at warp speed. These were heralded as a forthcoming panacea that would save mankind and restore normalcy. As soon as they were mass deployed, public health officials would lift the restrictions on social and economic life. While many observers were thunderstruck by this turn of events, there were historical precedents. In his 1961 farewell address, President Eisenhower warned, "We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes." As Dr. McCullough and his colleagues learned, Eisenhower's warning has become equally applicable to the biopharmaceutical complex of multinational drug companies, the NIH, and other federal agencies, research and virology labs, and the Gates Foundation. Since COVID-19 arrived, this complex has obtained misplaced power over every aspect of our lives and taken our liberties. The Courage to Face COVID-19 recounts how Dr. McCullough and his colleagues began their work by fighting a novel infectious disease and then became leaders in fighting the tyrannical regime that endangers our American way of life. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Courage to Face COVID-19, Preventing Hospitalization and Death While Battling the Biopharmaceutical Complex, with my special guest, investigative journalist and author, John Leake. Thank you very much for this interview, and welcome back to the program, John Leake.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this incredible book.
Well, I appreciate the compliment. I worked on it for, I don't know, 2.5 years, and a lot of research and contemplation. So I appreciate your interest in it.
As you do in the book, in the prologue, you set the stage for this very important story contained in this book. October 19th, 2019, John Hopkins Center for Public Security, in collaboration with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the World Economic Forum, conducted a pandemic simulation exercise they called Event 201. Tell us about this simulation on October 19, 2009. What disease did they feature? Tell us the details of what was conducted.
Well, this event at Johns Hopkins, in collaboration with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the World Economic Forum, it was just the latest in a series of what they call pandemic simulations. This one in October 19th of 2019, Event 201, referring to at any given time, you know, over the course of a year or two, you might have 200 potentially infectious diseases emerging, but number 201 is the one that is infectious and contagious amongst humans. So this idea that, well, you know, we're preparing for this thing, that it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when we are going to get a fully contagious respiratory viral epidemic. It's coming. And so this was just the latest. The timing, of course, is quite interesting. I mean, we know now that the SARS-CoV-2, the causative agent of COVID-19 illness, was already circulating in Wuhan, China at this time. And we also know that one of the participants in Event 201 was the Chinese equivalent of the head of our CDC, a guy, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name properly, Dr. Gao, G-A-O. Right. So you've got the Chinese counterpart of the CDC. There he is at Event 201. And wow, surprise, surprise, a coronavirus is actually already circulating in Wuhan at this time. The simulation imagines a scenario in which a coronavirus pandemic kicks off. In this simulation, it kicks off in Brazil. I perceive, I'll just jump right in and say, I perceive that to be a little bit of misdirection. As had already been determined, the next likely coronavirus pandemic would in fact come out of China, because SARS-CoV-1 came out of China in 2002 and 2003. So Brazil's kind of an interesting, in my opinion, in my estimation, a bit of misdirection. But anyway, an out-of-control coronavirus, they give it the nickname CAPS, C-A-P-S, is raging around the world. And in the pandemic simulation, what is the medical establishment, the public health agencies in Washington, and the media establishment, how are they to respond to this pandemic? So that's the simulation. You can still watch the videos. They're still published online of Event 201, and it is uncanny in its prescience that, you know, we're to believe that no one had any idea this was actually already happening.
I think what was the most fascinating part of it, as you write, was that the predictions on how the public would react and how the media would react, again, very, very prescient in that prediction.
Well, you know, there is a long-standing methodology of propaganda, of shaping public opinion, of throttling information that would be, you know, possibly distract the public or take the public away from the orthodox narrative that is being propagated. So these guys actually talk about some of these propaganda techniques. One of the ones that is specifically mentioned is an old propaganda technique called flooding the zone, which is simultaneously over multiple media channels broadcasting the identical message. And there are multiple examples that I document as the true story unfolds of the COVID-19 pandemic of extraordinary examples of flooding the zone. So all of this is discussed, all of it's contemplated. I think the one thing in Event 201 that the script was a little bit changed up when it came to the actual pandemic a few months later is that Event 201 does, the panel participants, they do acknowledge that yes, it would be valuable to have a vaccine and to get it up and running as quickly as possible. Nevertheless, some of the main participants say, but in the early days of the pandemic, as people are getting sick, it will be necessary to treat them. So, you know, we're going to have to look at the pharmacopoeia of available drugs, drugs that are already available, that are known to have a good safety profile. And we're going to have to find one that could help people, that could at least provide maybe not a silver bullet, but that could reduce the severity of symptoms. When we see the actual pandemic arrive a few months later, we see that the entire concept of early treatment is systematically suppressed in favor of the mass vaccination solution or purported solution. That is to say, in the simulation, there is a recognition that early treatment will be necessary because it could take quite some time to develop a safe and effective vaccine, possibly 2 or 3 years. So we're going to have to find ways to treat people. When we have the actual pandemic, it's the exact opposite. The message is there is no treatment. Somehow we already know that, which is an interesting question. How could you already know that there is no treatment given it's a novel infectious agent? But anyway, that gets into the theme of our book. Why were early treatment modalities suppressed? That's the central question of the book.
Now, give our audience your formal education and background, and also your background as an author and nonfiction author as well, a true crime author and nonfiction author, pardon me. But also how you found out about Peter McCullough, Dr. Peter McCullough, and how you made the decision. Tell us about the decision to write a book with Dr. McCullough.
Well, my formal education is in history and philosophy. I have a master's degree in philosophy, but I grew up in a very literate household. My grandfather, he's technically my step-grandfather. He was my grandmother's second husband, was a Harvard-trained doctor that had a huge library of books on medical history. I just got fascinated by medical history when I was pretty young. I mean, an early teenager. My grandparents lived in the country and I'd go spend weeks at a time and I would talk to my grandfather about medical history. And so that was kind of a childhood fascination. I went to Vienna, Austria on a graduate school scholarship to study philosophy while I was in the city. Vienna, I stumbled across a true crime story about an Austrian serial killer. There was a twist. He wasn't only a serial killer. He was also a fairly famous author and journalist. His name was Jack Unterweger. And the remarkable twist in the story is when these women started disappearing from the Vienna red light district, and turning up dead in the Vienna woods. It was this, the subject of my book, Jack Unterweger is his name. He actually became a kind of lead reporter for Austrian National Radio, reporting on the unknown, undetected serial killer. So it was a rather remarkable story of a guy reporting on his own crimes. He actually interviewed the chief of police and the friends of the murdered women, and he really went deep. Anyway, he was ultimately exposed as being the killer. But while I was researching that book, I got to be friends with the pathologist at the Vienna Institute of Forensic Medicine, and I served as her translator for a while from German into English. I just grew really fascinated, or became fascinated, in forensic medicine. You know, how do forensic doctors, or in the case of the U.S. jurisdiction, medical examiners, you know, how do they ascertain how we die and why do we die? So I became adept at reading medical literature, and I became interested in epidemiology and this whole area of science and knowledge. And so at the beginning of 2020, when we got the first reports of SARS-CoV-1 emanating from China, it then spread to Milan, Italy. I spent quite a bit of time in Italy and I'm very interested in Italian culture. And so I was paying pretty close attention to the reporting out of Milan. And then, you know, I just began to think a lot of what we're being told by our public health officials just doesn't really add up to me. I began to suspect that there are distinct elements of a distorted reality, even elements of fraud. And I know, as a true crime author, that, you know, all crime contains elements of fraud, of distorting reality, deception. And so I began researching what was going on, reading different reports from all over the world, and I decided this looks like an organized crime story in the making. But I knew I needed an expert scientific medical witness to help me to evaluate a lot of the technical aspects of what we were seeing. And so I began searching for my criteria were a high-ranking academic medical doctor, one who has a publishing resume. What separates the men from the boys in academic medicine is your publishing resume.
Right.
And preferably one who's also treating patients, who has a clinical practice. And then my final criterion was he would also have to be a guy who is critically evaluating the orthodoxy coming out of Washington. That is to say, the NIH, Health and Human Services. Like, what we're looking at is a federal public health apparatus that is telling us what's going on. I was skeptical of a lot of their claims. I wanted to find a doctor who was also skeptical of the orthodoxy at the time. And my first question is, well, where am I going to find this guy? He's kind of a unicorn. And then through some twists and turns that I document in the book, I discovered that Dr. Peter McCullough lived about a mile from me in Dallas. I contacted him. We met for an interview, beautiful in-studio interview, beautifully photographed and mic'd. I posted it on YouTube, and it was censored about 3 hours later.
Wow.
So that's when I realized, boy, we're in the middle of something really, really big here, and it is completely inimical to the spirit of the U.S. Constitution and the First Amendment.
Let's talk about what Peter McCullough, Dr. McCullough, found out. But from the early reports from France, South Korea, and China, and India, about hydroxychloroquine, chloroquine, and the research being done in terms of treatment for COVID-19.
Well, you know, going back to that pandemic 201, they explicitly say, you know, we're going to have to scramble because it's going to take a while to develop a safe and effective vaccine, if that's even possible. That's an unknown, but we're going to need to scramble to find drugs that are have a known safety profile that could be used to treat this. So that actually was understood to be a normal procedure. Like, again, look at the pharmacopoeia, you know, look at safe drugs that are known to have a safe profile, you know, preferably ones that have been used by humanity for decades. Then you know it has a good safety profile. So you had independent, creative, thinking doctors who immediately start looking for anything that could be used to treat this. And I want to say, this is important. You know, a lot of medicine isn't necessarily a silver bullet. I mean, penicillin was a miracle drug because you would take a staphylococcal infection that was dangerous or a syphilis infection, things that were just scourges of mankind for centuries, and penicillin would just blast it. I mean, you're talking like 2 days later, you're feeling better. But there aren't that many miracle drugs like penicillin. A lot of drugs, it's reduction of symptoms. It's just helping the patient to get through the syndrome so that he doesn't have to go to hospital and doesn't die. So that's what the doctors, the good doctors, were looking for. And there's a guy in Marseille, France, named Didier Raoult, and he is, I think, the most published microbiologist on Earth. In the year 1990, if my memory serves, he came up with a treatment for a very, very dangerous, I mean, a very high fatality rate illness called Q fever. And Q fever, it's not very common, but if you get it, I mean, it's like 50% curtains. And Didier Raoult in Marseille, he discovered that you could treat Q fever with the combination of hydroxychloroquine and, I believe, doxycycline, and it works. And it became and remains today the standard treatment for Q fever. I think Raoult has personally discovered several hundred species of bacteria. And he's also credited with discovering the giant virus, a species of giant virus, which I think had previously been perceived to be some other organism. Raoult proved that it was a virus. So this is an eminent infectious disease biologist and treating physician. He's a member of the Legion of Honor. And so Didier Raoult starts looking at the literature. He sees that there is a published literature, including NIH scientists in the United States, who discovered that the old malarial drug, also used for rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, hydroxychloroquine, had antiviral and anti-inflammatory efficacy against SARS-CoV-1, which was genetically pretty close to SARS-CoV-2. So Raoult says, all right, hydroxychloroquine, great safety profile, billions of doses taken and tolerated for a variety of illnesses, FDA approved over-the-counter in France. It's actually an over-the-counter agent. So he's like, let's give it a shot. The amazing thing is immediately upon his announcement, and there's no one in the entire country of France better equipped to evaluate this than Professor Raoult. Immediately upon announcing that hydroxychloroquine combined with azithromycin seems to have pretty good efficacy, especially when administered early, he's massively censured and censored. Immediately. It's like, no, 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 no. That, you know, imagine you're at a cocktail party and you tell someone a true story, and before you even get halfway into it, the guy starts waving his hands in your face and saying, no way, no way, don't tell that story. Very, very suspicious. And so Peter McCullough catches wind of Didier Raoult's work in Marseille, and he begins to think as well, like, what's going on here? Like, this is a perfectly safe drug. Why are we suddenly being told it's dangerous? When Dr. McCullough worked at a hospital in Seattle, he routinely prescribed hydroxychloroquine for rheumatoid arthritis. So, like, what is going on here? And, you know, that is a kind of a key opening chapter in the book, recounting Professor Raoult's adventures in France trying to treat patients, trying to prevent them and succeeding from having to go to hospital.
Let's talk about remdesivir and who has interest in this drug being successful on the marketplace and its relationship and comparison to hydroxychloroquine.
Remdesivir was an experimental drug developed by a biotech company in San Francisco who, whose name is suddenly slipping me, but I'll remember it. The company in San Francisco worked closely with the head of the NIAID, Anthony Fauci, to develop remdesivir. They had initially thought it would be a useful drug for treating Ebola. With Dr. Fauci's, you know, NIH assistance, they did some trials of this drug, remdesivir, in an Ebola outbreak in Africa. They found that it didn't work. And in fact, the experimental group that received it had a considerably higher fatality rate than the control group who didn't. So it was an utter failure. Gilead Pharmaceutical Company, isn't it? Gilead Sciences. That's the company that developed remdesivir. So it was an abysmal failure in its Ebola trials. It's kind of back to the drawing board. They tried it with Zika as well. Again, the trials didn't work. An abject failure against Zika. But then, you know, if it doesn't work, just keep trying. So with SARS-CoV-2, they decided to try remdesivir against SARS-CoV-2. I go into, it's quite a bit of technical detail about the trial data in the book. It's clear that remdesivir has zero efficacy against SARS-CoV-2. Even the WHO, which tends to go in lockstep with the NIH, even the WHO issued a viso in October of 2020 saying, don't use remdesivir. There's no indication that it works. And secondly, there are indications that it causes kidney damage. Nevertheless, Anthony Fauci and his friends at Gilead and Bill Gates, who is a Gilead shareholder, they did succeed in persuading the Health and Human Services and the CDC and the FDA to get behind remdesivir as the, and this is quite a notable detail for people who've studied medicine, remdesivir became the standard of care for gravely ill hospitalized patients with COVID-19. So I appreciate this is a bit technical, but it was already well understood that with a viral respiratory viral illness, it usually proceeds in three stages. The first stage is the viral replication phase. The virus is rapidly replicating in the upper respiratory tract. Stage two, you get into pulmonary difficulty. The patient finds it difficult to breathe. That difficulty of breathing and accompanied anxiety will oftentimes prompt them to go to hospital. That's stage two of the illness. By the time you get to stage two, the early viral replication phase has ended. It has long been understood that if you are trying to stop a viral disease in its tracks by using an antiviral agent, you administer it early during the early viral replication phase. Take a look at Tamiflu, an antiviral for influenza. The indication is start as early as possible. So why the fuck are they administering this for gravely ill patients in hospital who are actually using supplementary oxygen? It just makes no sense whatsoever. Nothing. And I carefully document this in my book. Nothing about the remdesivir protocol makes sense. Not one element of it. Now, what does make sense from a money-making standpoint is these gangsters succeeded in persuading Health and Human Services, Medicare, and Medicaid to give hospitals a 20% bonus on the patient's entire hospital bill if the hospital administered remdesivir. So that is a perverse incentive. We're saying we will pay you a 20% bonus on the entire hospital bill if you administer this emergency authorized use product with an abysmal safety record. Even the WHO does not recommend it if you administer this to your gravely ill hospitalized patients. And I've interviewed multiple nurses who have told me that with a patient in those circumstances, on about day two after administering remdesivir, the urine output starts to decrease and clear signs in the blood panel of kidney damage, of impaired kidney function begin to manifest. So why are they administering this in hospital?
You ask the question why, but also at the same time, by criticizing hydroxychloroquine, calling it irreversible retinal damage and dangerous heart arrhythmias, which is ironic, at the same time praising resveratrol as the only option.
Just stop and consider this. So hydroxychloroquine was approved by the FDA for indications with malaria, the off-label uses for rheumatoid arthritis and lupus in the 50s. Okay, so for decades, billions of doses of this. You know who called bullshit on this idea that it causes retinal damage? It was ophthalmologists. They're the first guys to say, what on earth is our media talking about? Because ophthalmologists will see, people will come to the ophthalmologist with a pigmentation. It is a damage of the retina after taking daily doses of hydroxychloroquine for over a decade. Over a decade, you start to see retinal damage. Okay, that's daily doses of this for rheumatoid arthritis for 10 years. What Professor Didier Raoul was recommending, his hydroxychloroquine protocol, 5 days. So this is just a lie. And I'm sorry, you know, it's funny, I'm now thinking about this book. I wrote it 2 years ago. Just all of this is just, it's just absolutely infuriating. And our mainstream media just happily parrots these utter perfidious lies.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages. Now, let's get to the players that enabled all of this. Someone is responsible, and some players are more responsible. You talk about Dr. Bright and Dr. Fauci, October 29, 2019, discussing a need for a universal flu vaccine. And they talked about touted new biotechnological tools. Now, fast forward to 2020, and what is Dr. Fauci doing, and what is he declaring while at the same time criticizing hydroxychloroquine and saying that it could be damaging and harmful, and as a result, doctors and hospitals are recommended to not do anything involving hydroxychloroquine.
So Rick Bright was the head of BARDA. It's a division of the Department of Health and Human Services, the acronym BARDA, Advanced Research something. Anyway, BARDA is a research division of Health and Human Services. Rick Bright was the head of it. He and Tony Fauci were talking about the need to, at Milken University in California, they were talking about the need to develop the next generation of influenza vaccine. And you know, they lament that the current technology for this upper respiratory tract viral infection goes back to the 50s. We need a new generation of vaccines against respiratory tract viral infections that could be rapidly developed. And they do make Rick Bright in particular references adenoviral and messenger RNA vaccine technology, which was still, you know, being developed. It was kind of an enticing, interesting idea, had been on the shelves of research and design departments for years, but no one had actually developed a vaccine on that platform in spite of an interest in doing so. So they say, well, you know, the next pandemic, you know, this would be an opportunity to catapult forward this next generation of vaccine technology. Fast forward 3 months, again, amazing prescience, these guys talking about this while SARS-CoV-2 is circulating in Wuhan. Fast forward, you know, 3 months, Anthony Fauci announces that, well, you know, the NIAID, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, turns out we've been co-developing a vaccine, a messenger RNA vaccine with Moderna, a biotech company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, never had a licensed pharmaceutical product ever, was developed with a Department of Defense grant. Their working capital came from the Department of Defense. Turns out NIAID and Moderna have been working on a messenger RNA vaccine, and they've got the prototype up and running with generous funding from the Gates Foundation. And of special note is a Gates Foundation World Economic Forum offshoot called CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovations, a new institution announced at the World Economic Forum's January 2017 annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland. So CEPI is in the business of rapid vaccine development. So CEPI is, I believe, in the press release, providing the funding for the human clinical trial of this new mRNA vaccine. So Rick Bright, Fauci's crony, at the same time that Fauci announces this new mRNA prototype vaccine for COVID-19, Rick Bright gives a $500 million grant to accelerate the development at Moderna. At the same time, Rick Bright is lobbying the FDA to restrict the availability of hydroxychloroquine as an early treatment protocol. So it's clear the paper trail, the press releases, the press interviews, Rick Bright is suppressing hydroxychloroquine while promoting the mRNA vaccine. at one and the same time. Smear the early treatment modality while promoting and financing the vaccine solution. Now, here's where I want to add something. A vaccine cannot treat someone who's already sick. It's not a treatment modality.
Right.
It is a immunological modality. The idea of a vaccine is to prevent you from getting the infection. It can't treat you if you already have it. So when Bright is out suppressing hydroxychloroquine, making it unavailable in New York State pharmacies, that means that people who are already sick with COVID can't get it, even though there's no vaccine available to have prevented them from getting the illness. They're already sick with it. So this is just sick. I mean, the whole thing, here's the problem with this story. It's so preposterous and so perfidious that people can't believe it. I mean, my book with Dr. McCullough is, we have over 300 citations. There's not a single statement in the book that is not fully supportable by public documents and records. And yet, it's hard for people to comprehend.
Let's talk about, you write about the courage to face COVID-19, and you say courage is that trait that's very, very important here. And we get back to Dr. McCullough and his protocol and what he's doing to save patients. And even people's own families were inflicted with this COVID-19. So it becomes a dire and important issue for everyone. And so you talk about what exactly was done instead of that protocol wasn't accepted. But tell us more about the fight for Dr. McCullough to get and save patients.
Well, what's fascinating about Dr. McCullough is he had, it's his discovery that in many ways he was a naive man. When he starts reading the reports of this, he just immediately assumes that my Hippocratic oath demands that I try my very best to the best of my ability and judgment to quote the Hippocratic oath to help my patients. And look, I mean, the game is on, we're in the ring. Like, you can't say, I can't try. No, you've got to fight. You've got to do something. Find a solution. Do the best you can. That's what he thought he was obliged to do pursuant to his Hippocratic oath. He starts treating patients. Initially, it's a combination of hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin. He realizes quickly, talking to the nephrologist at his hospital, that the kidneys the kidneys are for some reason clotting. And the dialysis lines are actually seeing clotting in the lines. It's like, why is this illness causing blood clotting? And so he thinks, well, clearly whatever this disease is, it's thrombotic. It causes clotting. So he's like, well, let's use blood thinners. Let's use extra strength aspirin and other blood thinners. And then in terms of pulmonary inflammation, well, for 50 years, we've used methylprednisolone. It's a steroid that is used to treat lung inflammation. So we'll use methylprednisolone. FDA approved, been around forever, standard of care for lung inflammation. And he is astonished when the hospital, pursuant to directives from the NIH, says, no, you can't use methylprednisolone for pulmonary inflammation. You can't use antithrombotics, blood thinners, for this clotting. And he says, well, like, why not? That's how we've always treated pulmonary inflammation and excessive clotting or thrombosis. So he's just stunned. It's like, well, what on earth are you talking about? We've used these drugs for decades. So in many ways, the story is Dr. McCullough's journey. It's a sort of hero's journey from naivete to the discovery that our modern biopharmaceutical medical complex was against treating patients. And I repeat, opposed to treating patients in the early phase of the illness in order to keep them out of hospital. So, and the consequences for doing so were grave. So I track Dr. McCullough's the onset of persecution. He's invited to give Senate testimony on early treatment on November the 19th, 2020. And shortly after his testimony, he starts receiving notices from hospital attorneys telling him to shut up. He's shortly thereafter fired from his hospital. He's shortly thereafter sued by his hospital. And it's just one thing after another. His professorships at three universities are revoked. His editorial positions at multiple academic journals are revoked. Just the knives come out for him. And why? Because he treated his patients with FDA-approved repurposed drugs.
Let's talk about some of the players that have this incredible vested interest. We haven't mentioned Bill Gates, Anthony Fauci, but also NIH, NIAID as well. Who holds these patents and who would profit the most from these patents?
The NIAID had a co-ownership entitling, so this is Anthony Fauci's division of the National Institutes of Health, held a co-licensing agreement on the Moderna vaccine, mRNA vaccine. So Fauci's saying, we don't believe hydroxychloroquine works. You know, we're going with the vaccine solution. He has an economic interest in that. So the evidence is clear that Fauci has a conflict of interest because he stands to receive an economic benefit from this monolithic vaccine solution. You know, Moderna, Stéphane Bancel, the French CEO of Moderna, he becomes a multi-billionaire in the space of a year. I mean, a lot of guys got really, really rich with this pandemic response. There's a lot of them. Bill Gates announced at the January meeting of the World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos, he told the Wall Street Journal and Betty Quick with Squawk Box, he said, vaccines are by far my greatest investment. I mean, we've had a 20x return on our investments in vaccines. So he just is openly saying this is the greatest business model ever, like better than software. Again, it's so out in the open that this is an industrial complex with deep, deep economic interests, and not to mention interests of power and control and augmenting power and control. These guys just plainly state it. But because it's couched in this language of philanthropy, we care about humanity, people can't see it. They can't see the ruthless self-interest in this complex. Now, that title or subtitle, Battling the Biopharmaceutical Complex, it's the subtitle of the book. That title derives from President Eisenhower's farewell address in 1959, in which President Eisenhower warned the American people about the undue influence of the military-industrial complex. This complex of defense industry, Department of Defense, and the public treasury is getting way too much power. And it's a threat to our democratic processes. So that was Eisenhower that issued that warning. He was a Supreme Allied Commander, so he's hardly an enemy of the military. But he saw this, and he was frightened of it, and he warned the American people. This biopharmaceutical complex is just an outgrowth of the military-industrial complex. A lot of the grants for these vaccine developments come from the Department of Defense.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages. You talk about the comparison with the pharmaceutical, biopharmaceutical industry and its similarity to the military-industrial complex. Just like the military-industrial complex is involved in every aspect of politics, and it's very politicalized, tell us about how this was also involved in politics in such a great way.
Well, what enabled this whole disaster fiasco to happen is in 2005, it was during the Bush administration, there was this purported anthrax attack on a federal facility in Washington. So this idea that, you know, it's not going to be Scud missiles that hit the American mainland. We have two huge oceans on both sides, the biggest navy in the world. So we don't have to worry about armed men invading the country. What we need to worry about are infectious disease pathogens. So Congress passes what's called the PREP Act, Preparation for Infectious Disease Pandemics. And what is presented in this piece of legislation is the following. So there could be bioweapons or naturally emerging infectious diseases that come to the American mainland. Congress and the government has to be equipped to deal with this. Public health emergency, very similar to a military invasion like Pearl Harbor. Okay. So how do we do this? Well, if we're invaded by an infectious disease or a biological weapons attack, Health and Human Services can declare a public emergency. When that public emergency is declared, anyone who is an authorized manufacturer or provider of what are called countermeasures, okay? So that comes from military science. The enemy is moving. A countermeasure is, you know, some way to counter the enemy. So pursuant to Health and Human Services, the PREP Act, anyone who's in the business of making a countermeasure to defeat this invading infectious disease enemy, their products receive liability protection. And because it's a countermeasure during a public health emergency, the government pays for the product. So your sophisticated, you know, listeners will probably recognize that this is a nice setup, a nice work if you can get it. So infectious disease or bioweapons attack, I'm in the business of making some bullshit experimental vaccine that doesn't work, but it's an emergency. Desperate times called for desperate measures. The government will pay you tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions, for your countermeasure and absolve you from liability if anyone is hurt by it.
So tell us, obviously, the political fight that you chronicle in this book as well. It seems that just because President Trump said that hydroxychloroquine was effective, that a good part of the population thought we have to do the opposite, and this person has no credibility. And you say that there is a financial motive, obviously, for the pharmaceutical, biopharmaceutical complex to be able to influence the political situation, the political reality, but also in terms of advertising on mainstream media.
Yeah, so Trump is just citing DDA. People don't realize this. He's just citing the most published infectious disease biologist on earth, a paper that DDA Raoult had just published the day before. Someone in Trump's staff gave him a synopsis of Professor Raoult's study, and Trump said, sounds good. You see, half the country is suffering from a severe mental distortion or disturbance. I mean, it's probably safe to say or fair to say Trump derangement syndrome. I mean, I've always thought that Trump's kind of a buffoon, but that doesn't mean just because you perceive a man to have buffoonish tendencies, sure. that doesn't mean that every single thing he says is automatically false. In this case, he was citing the most published infectious disease biologist, microbiologist, you know, in Europe, if not the world. But because Trump delivered the message, you know, half the country categorically assumes that it can't be true. Of all of the things that I document in the book, this is probably the single stupidest. Okay, so at the exact same time that Trump says this, or I should say that at the White House press briefer the next day, all of these journalists have now come with the exact same script, you know, that hydroxychloroquine, you know, you have no scientific basis for saying this, yada, yada, yada. They've all obviously just received this the same script. So Trump is saying, well, look, I mean, it's perfectly safe. It's not going to hurt anybody. What else are you offering? The next day, the Washington Post, which is known to be an organ of our intelligence agencies in Washington, says Trump's crazy for proposing this. What we really need, what the real scientists are focusing on, is this new vaccine that Moderna and the NIAID is getting up and running. So you see all of this happening. It's very clear if you're paying attention, if you understand how to read and analyze this, it's child's play to see through all of this. I'm sorry I'm speaking in a rather vehement way, but this is child's play. The American people have just been subjected to so much propaganda that they can't see what's going on here. And then, you know, surprise, surprise, Anthony Fauci himself knew all along. He published a paper in November 2022 with two NIH colleagues in which they explicitly acknowledge, you know, it's really hard to develop a vaccine against an upper respiratory tract infection. Why is that? Because the virus replicates in the nasal passage before it comes into contact with the primary immune system in the blood. So it's replicating in your nose, and you're expelling it from your nose, passing it on to others before it's challenged by the body's primary immune system. Fauci knew that. He knew that this new vaccine that he's touting can't prevent infection and transmission. It can't. And what happened in the autumn of 2021? Rochelle Walensky, the CDC director, came out and admitted it can't prevent infection and transmission. All it can do, she claims falsely, is reduce the severity of symptoms. So this is all a lie. The whole thing, every element of this is a fraud. It's the greatest fraud ever committed.
Not only are we talking about fraud, you talk about that this is an example of a crime against humanity. And so there are people that are culpable for unnecessary death.
Well, also, where did this infectious agent come from? It came from a laboratory collaboration between Professor Ralph Baric at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's the world's foremost expert on coronaviruses. His collaboration with Shengji Li, a biologist, a lead biologist at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. There's a massive paper trail explicitly stating that they're doing gain of function work on bat SARS coronaviruses at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Now, your readers are interested in crime, okay? So somebody tells you there are bat caves in southern China. over 1,000 miles away from Wuhan, which is in a temperate climate. The first circulating cases of this flu-like illness are in Wuhan, about 4 miles from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. These caves of bats that contain bat coronaviruses are 1,000 miles away. So where are you going to look for the origin of this infectious agent? Are you going to look in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which by its own publications is performing gain of function work on bat coronaviruses to deliberately make them infectious to the human respiratory tract? Where do you think this came from?
Yes.
I mean, I know you got to be a regular Columbo. I mean, a Hercule Poirot or Sherlock Holmes to figure this one out. It's so stupid that I can't even, it just makes my head hurt. I mean, the paper trail on the research that was being done that created this thing is so big that, you know, if I just started rattling off the number of the papers, the research grants, just citing the titles, it would take me an hour. And yet, how is it possible that this is still a matter of controversy in the mainstream media? I can't even imagine how that's possible. I'll tell your audience one other thing. So the CEO of Moderna, the vaccine developer in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Stéphane Bancel, before he went to Moderna, he was the CEO of bioMérieux, a French diagnostics company. In 2003, bioMérieux signed a cooperative agreement with China to develop a new BSL-4 lab in Wuhan, an annex to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Bancel was the head of developing that new lab to study SARS coronaviruses and other infectious diseases in Wuhan. Okay. In 2000, and he was overseeing personnel and staffing the lab in Wuhan and so on and so forth. 2011, he goes to Moderna in Cambridge. Okay. In 2016, he and Moderna filed a patent in the U.S. Patent Office for a gene sequence. They got a patent on this particular gene sequence, okay, of a virus, a viral gene sequence. In 2021, a molecular biology team in Holland, in the Netherlands, they took the genome, the published genome of SARS-CoV-2, the infectious agent of COVID-19. And they analyzed the gene sequence, the genetic code, and they found a very interesting, I think it's a 19 nucleotide segment of this gene sequence that codes for the so-called furin cleavage site, I'm getting technical, of the spike protein on SARS-CoV-2. Okay, this is the little spiny part of the virus that enables it to dock to onto an epithelial cell in the respiratory tract. So this is the component, the genetic component of the virus that makes it possible to be contagious, to infect human respiratory tract cells. That piece of code, coding for the furin cleavage site of the spike protein, perfect match with the genetic sequence patented by Stéphane Bancel at Moderna in 2016. Using standard biostatistical analyses, the odds of that are 1 in 3 trillion. That means that Bancel and Moderna already had the key part of this infectious agent patented 4 years before the gene sequence of SARS-CoV-2 was published.
Wow.
How is that possible? And if you think that I'm making this up, you can go to my Substack, in which I provide the links to all of the original documents.
That's great. I think one of the biggest things that people don't really talk about, I was a big comic book reader, but the rationale for the gain of function experimentation in the first place is ludicrous.
Yes, the assertion is we have identified naturally occurring coronaviruses that are in the natural reservoir are bat caves in southern China. Okay, so we are going to theoretically posit that those viruses could ultimately, through natural evolutionary mutations, ultimately become infectious to humans. Okay, it's well understood that a bat coronavirus is not going to jump directly from a bat to a human. We're genetically too different. It's going to need what's called an intermediary host, some kind of a higher level mammal, a civet cat, a pig, you know, something that's closer to humans to enable it to make that subsequent evolutionary development where it could then become infectious to humans. Not only infectious, but infectious and contagious, human to human. Call that community spread potential. So we are going to posit that eventually, through a random evolutionary process, a coronavirus in these bats could eventually jump to human hosts. So what we're going to do is we're going to harvest those viruses from bats, going to take those samples to labs. We're going to do gain of function research in order to deliberately make them infectious to humans. And once we have a virus that is infectious to humans, we can then develop a vaccine countermeasure against it. So there is a professor named Richard E. Bright at Rutgers University who has been warning for years, this is really stupid. The risk profile, risk probability of this thing that you are making, you're altering it. You're using biotechnology to make it infectious to humans. The risk of that escaping from a lab is far higher, God knows how much higher, than the risk of a natural evolutionary eventual jump from bats to humans via an intermediary host. That could take 1,000 years, if not more. No one knows. No one can predict that. So here's the ultimate irony. When SARS-CoV-2 came out and the genome was published, Anthony Fauci, we now know this. Again, you think, how does John know this? It's all published. There's been Freedom of Information Acts. It's all out there. We all know this. It's just not being reported. Anthony Fauci showed the genome to a bunch of his virology buddies. And we now know from FOIA requests on the emails, their first response upon seeing the genome, particularly the foreign cleavage site, was, gee whiz, Anthony, this really looks artificial. This looks like it came out of a lab. Don't see how we could get some of these elements through natural evolution. Okay, that's in private email exchanges. What was publicly released was the exact opposite. These same guys published papers saying this looks like it's a naturally evolving thing. I kid you not. This was exactly what happened. One of the guys who said, gee whiz, Anthony, this looks kind of, like it didn't come about naturally, was a guy named Eddie Holmes, a virologist in Australia. In 2018, Eddie Holmes published a paper in Nature stating this whole predict proposition, the whole idea that you could somehow analyze viruses in nature and things like bats and predict which ones will eventually make the evolutionary jump to humans is total BS.
Sure.
So Eddie Holmes himself is saying that this whole gain of function project is based on a fallacious, illogical proposition with no scientific basis. So all of these guys are a bunch of liars and frauds, and they all belong in jail.
I want to thank you so much, John Leake, for coming on and talking about the courage to face COVID-19, preventing hospitalization and death while battling the biopharmaceutical complex. For those people that might want to check out your website and grab a copy of this book, tell us about your website and more about this book.
Well, my website can be found at authorjohnleake.com. That's author John Leake, JohnLeake.com. I also write a Substack for those of you who are unfamiliar with this platform. It's a free speech, dedicated to free speech platform for independent reporters and writers. My Substack with Dr. Peter McCullough is called Courageous Discourse with Dr. Peter McCullough and John Leake. There you'll find a lot of my reporting on this. And then my book, The Courage to Face COVID-19 with Dr. Peter McCullough, can be found at Amazon.com.
Thank you so much for this interview, John Leake, The Courage to Face COVID-19. Thank you so much for this interview, and have a great evening and good night.
You too. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Good night.